Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And this is Maltin on Movies, coming tonight from the Highball at Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas.
And the man golf clapping to my left is Tim Burton.
Yes.
Phew.
Is this where the bowling alley used to be? Or the, was yeah. it? Yeah. This used to be the bowling alley. Last year was a bowling alley.
Okay. Oh. No, it is currently a bowling alley.
Yeah, so duck.
And so,
often.
Yes, exactly. That's what's going to happen.
Clear the lane. Let's do it.
It's a really cool place and a wonderful place for conversation. And the now, have any of you just seen Tim's new movie, Miss Peregrine's School for Peculiar Children? Great. They've just been screening it here at Fantastic Fest, and a big premiere, big hoo-ha, a lot of to do. We got to see it in L.A. the other day, so it is fresh in our minds.
Yes.
And thank you for making another Tim Burton movie.
I can't do anything else. I mean, unfortunately. It's good and bad quality.
But it does force the chicken and egg question, because it is based on a very successful book, which I read sold over 3 million copies. And so did they come to you, or did you come to them for this?
No, I'd never heard about the book. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not a big reader. It was probably about a year or so after it came out, and probably the first book I ever liked before I read it, because I liked all the photographs. There was something about I collect photographs myself, and something about the old photographs, the sort of weird, haunting nature that I just love. So then I read the story, and it just had themes that I connected with. But then I thought, maybe did I write this book? And then I said, no, I did some bizarre, hallucination. But no, but it just, there's a lot of themes that spoke to me,
And clearly so. Now,
you wouldn't think that something with the word peculiar in the title would appeal to you.
I would have used fucked up children, but not.
There you go. There you go. Please don't curse in front of my dad. He gets very upset.
No.
Bad Tim Burton. Okay. Bad.
I'll put my money in the swear box.
Well, it is funny because it does seem such a natural fit, a perfect fit for you. And what I wonder is when you read the screenplay, and obviously you also work on the screenplay, but when you read the screenplay, or if we were to read it now, what would we see, what wouldn't we see that you add to it, is what I'm trying to get at. There's a finished screenplay, there's a screenwriter,
Jane Goldman
who has done a lot of other good work.
Yes.
And if we were to just read it on the page, would we get a sense of your touch, or does that only come in the next layering of your involvement?
Well, I mean, I don't know. That's an interesting question, because, I mean, I tried to be true to the spirit of the book and all.
Right.
But that's why I don't think I could ever make a proper horror or drama, because I always find something slightly funny in things, mm-hmm. I mean, if I went to, like, don't invite me to a wedding, a serious play, or a funeral, because I'll just start laughing.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't, I don't know. I think there's other people out there
that.
I mean, it's just the more. So, it may be a serious book or a serious thing, but I always find some kind of weird thing that amuses me. Maybe it won't amuse anybody else, but I do find certain things funny. So that is not there necessarily in the material.
Right. But as you're not alone, because you have a following, and a large following around the world, and have built one and maintained one all these years. We were talking about this over dinner, that, I mean, this is a film about outsiders, as so many of your films are, and I suppose it would not be unfair to say that you considered yourself an outsider as a kid, because you had interests that weren't the mainstream interests, and if any of you were lucky enough to see the great museum, the touring museum show of Tim's career,
to see it at LACMA.
And
amazing.
It's great. If anybody has it's in Shanghai, so that's some free time. Right. You can go to Shanghai.
Just hop on a plane and go to Shanghai, which would be a good reason to go to Shanghai. But I mean, I start to wonder, if he was an outsider and he's made all these films about outsiders from an outsider's point of view, who are all of us who love him? I guess we're all outsiders. I guess we're not such a minority after all. It feels that way when you're a kid, though.
Everybody feels, you know, I mean, that's the fun. I always find things that people that don't feel, that like to categorize people and put them in a box and say you're weird or you're this or you're that. It's like, well, they're stranger to me than anybody. You know, it's like I always felt more comfortable with people that, you know, because I always felt like people that were sort of deemed peculiar, we, like in my mind, were like quiet, internal, artistic, you know, sensitive. And, you know, it's like, why are you being, you know, sort of tortured or put into this category when basically you're just a human being who feels things, you know?
Yes, exactly. When what struck me about the museum show, because it was laid out chronologically, was we saw some of your work from your school years, you know, when you were literally a kid, and some of your early drawings, some of your posters, some of the great posters you did with the Frankenstein monster, screenings that you and others had of 8mm movies and things, and 16mm movies. And there seems to be just this absolute continuum, a through line.
Seeing your journals and your doodles seems like that just like what you
like
do
an
now.
Insane person, yeah.
But our kind of insane person, someone that we'd want to be insane with.
Well, I mean, that's how I, you know, I mean, I think when I won $10 and I had my poster put on the garbage trucks of Burbank for a month, I mean, you know, it gave me a taste of success.
And they also had some of your earliest home movies. And I tried making 8mm home movies, too. And I tried doing my version of stop motion, which was mostly stop, not enough motion. But very hard
to
do.
He got halfway.
And in those days, they didn't have a single frame adjustment on. My dad's camera didn't have one. So you had to try to press the thing as gently as you could and get a little exposure and then move your little figure or your little paper cutout. And there you are trying to do Ray Harryhausen, you know.
Well, no, I mean, if you look at those early ones in the show, I mean, you see hands coming in quite a bit. Same thing, you know. The technology was not good, is good back then, yes.
But it is a feeling of power, isn't it? It's like, oh, my gosh, I could make this happen.
Well, I mean, that's why I love stop motion so much, because it is like it's a tactile thing where you have something there on the set, and they move it frame by frame. And it is like, you know, it's like Frankenstein or Pinocchio. It's something coming to life, you know, and you can see it. And there's something that's just so exciting about, you know, I love all forms of animation, but that one in particular is just quite, you know, energizing, you know. Yeah. It's really beautiful.
I love seeing all the heads.
Yeah,
that's one of the things that was on display, if you guys didn't get to see it, is they had all of Jack's heads, Jack Skellington's heads, and so they had him mouth open, mouth closed, mouth open a little bit wider, a little bit, just incredible.
If you move these puppets, they're just so beautifully made, and this is what, you know, the collaboration of an art form and movies and anything, it's like the people that make these things are real beautiful artists and, you know, geniuses in a way that make these armatures and things. So, you know, I've been very lucky to work with amazing people, but that form of animation is still my favorite because it's just so tactile.
And we get a little taste of it in Miss Peregrine, too, which is nice.
I would have done more, but it's time-consuming, so, you know, but that one particular, one little sequence in the film where we're able to do stop motion.
Well, now, when you started making films and when you went to Cal Arts eventually and studied animation and then apprenticed at Disney, there was no such thing, children, listen carefully, there was no such thing as CGI. It hadn't been invented yet. Nothing was being done with computers on a home level, certainly. And now, because you've lived through these decades of change, you've not only seen it happen, but you're now working with it, and you've been working with it for a while. But it doesn't seem like not having it ever stunted your imagination.
No, I mean, look, I mean, I've been around so long where, you know, if you were hanging somebody by a wire, you couldn't even remove that, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's like Superman, where you see still the wires. I mean, you know, the technology has moved on very quickly, but that's even, like, that's in my lifetime where you couldn't even do that. So, but it's all a tool. I never try to think of anything as sort of the way to go, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like animation. Drawn animation is great, you know, stop motion computer. It's all beautiful. It just, you know, use it in the right, just use it as a tool to tell whatever you want to tell.
Right, but do you find that your imagination can roam more freely or more widely or even wildly because you can achieve so much now?
No, I mean, look at it. I mean, I did Beetlejuice, which got the worst effects of all time, you know? But they're great because that's, you know, that's part of what that was. You know, I wouldn't necessarily take that and, you know, do Beetlejuice and like use all great computer animation things because it's not part of what that story is.
Right.
You know, certain things require, you know, and it's beautiful what you can do and amazing you can create anything, you know, but yeah, that's why every medium has its beauty and its power.
Sure. But in, just for example, though, in Miss Peregrine, you did shoot at Blackpool, which if it was kind of like the Coney Island of Britain, and with an amusement pier and all that kind of stuff, and you did shoot there because they have this fun house. But then when you shot there today, 2016, you then had to paint away what's really there today.
A little bit. I mean, not much. You know, I think that's why I like it. I don't know why I like these old faded amusement parks so
much.
Great.
Because
I mean,
Blackpool is epic.
Yeah, no,
they call it the Las Vegas of England. It's a ridiculous place.
It's more Lost Vegas. Yes.
Oh, so.
Yes.
Now, you know the biggest draw at the hotels that are on the waterfront? Is that they
prostitute.
No, that's the back alleys. No. On the actual waterfront, it's if they have elevators for people in wheelchairs. That's right. Fancy hotel has an elevator. Don't have to crawl up the steps.
But up in the top of the Blackpool Tower, they had like 20 live polar bears up at the top of the tower. I mean, it's like, it's the weirdest place. I mean, they don't have that anymore.
But, it's a trip.
Yeah, it is weird.
It's a special, weird place.
Another thing I want to ask you about is the fact that you got to... Well, I'm going to go backwards in time a little bit. We're going to talk about several of your movies that are favorites of ours. And one of my favorites is Ed Wood. And partly because I love the movie, period. Partly because I love the people and the characters in it. Tor Johnson always fascinated me as a kid, and still does to this very day. And you brought all of that to life with such simpatico, and Johnny Depp's performance in it is so perfect because Ed Wood, for those of you who don't know, is the fellow who in the 50s made what are often referred to as the worst movies of all time, like Plan 9 from Outer Space, which gave the late great Bela Lugosi one of his last screen roles, and the thing about Ed Wood is that he had ambition, he had passion, just no talent. That's all he was lacking.
Of course, here I am. Of course, why?
But he's so endearing and so engaging, and Johnny captures that so well. That look in his eyes, that look of isn't this great? And that's what he thought.
Well, that's what I loved about it. I mean, because it's a fine line between failure and success. To be known as the worst, you know, I mean, at least you're known for something, you know? and that beautiful passion that you have to have as a filmmaker where, you know, you think, you know, when he's making Plan 9, you know, he thought he was making Star Wars, you know? It's like, you know, it's something where you just have that passion and that weird kind of family that, and the weird sort of delusion that you have when you're making, as a filmmaker, that, you know, the passion, the belief that what you're doing. And so, you know, I just completely... You know, except for the women's clothing angle, I completely relate to him. You know? Yeah.
Yes, you can be honest. It's okay. Right.
He had a penchant for ladies' Angora sweaters. But you go see the movie. And if you haven't seen the movie, watch it again because it's still great. And, of course, you almost didn't get to make that movie because the studio that was going to make it or enable you to make it wouldn't make it in black and white.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, no, I remember being in one meeting where I said, I want to make it black and white. And they go, no. And they were on the phone because it was, I think they had more important things to do. They were going to promote the Last Action Hero, an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, and they were going to launch some satellite in outer space to, and I go like, well, who's going to see that? You're not going to make a movie in black and white, but you're going to spend the money to launch a satellite in outer space to promote the Last Action Hero. Okay, good luck. Goodbye. Next studio.
But fortunately, Disney came through and said, yes, you can make it in black and white.
Yes.
And it looks good.
You know, but then, you know, you make black... Look, I've been lucky, but they don't like it. They like Schindler's List, but beyond that, it's not... Forget it.
But if I have to choose between two movies made in black and white, what I'm going to watch tonight, probably going to be Ed Wood.
Well, no, I mean, I loved it. You know, I mean, I've been lucky to be able to because it's such a beautiful medium, you know, and we shot it in black and white. We didn't, you know, so... You know, I've always been very lucky to be able to kind of maneuver my way through and get whatever.
Yeah. But what I think is incredible is that while you use black and white the way you do, you also use color magnificently. Because like with just having seen Miss Peregrine, the first thing I saw, I mean, Colleen Atwood, who did the wardrobe, the costume design, and has, is it 11 projects with you? Many projects with you. It's just gorgeous, and the details in the hair, the details in the makeup, all of that. So I think it's really interesting that if you're going to go black and white, you want it to be the richest black and white it can be, and if you're going to go color, you want it to be the richest color it can be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it was part of my animation background or Cal Arts. I had, you know, many years of design, you know, and taught, you know, and we all know color and mood and everything. It all kind of goes together. So, you know, it's always like anything. Black and white, use it as a character. Same with color. Just try to... You know, every scene, it's an important mood enhancer color.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you can use it very sparingly if you choose.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about it. But it is, you know, it's like music or anything else or actors or any design element. It's part of the character of it. And so definitely think about it each time.
That's fine. Well, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, Beetlejuice and even Mars Attacks are almost garish use of color, but a deliberately garish use of color. Beetlejuice, I'm thinking of the Deo scene in particular. It's
it's the color affects you. So for me, it's always an important element. Yeah. You know, I always like, should this be animation or live action or you know whatever? And then is it black and white or is it color? And so it's all part of what the project is.
Yeah. Yeah. Where does it begin for you? I mean, if someone hasn't come to you, and in this case, somebody came to you and said, here's a book you should look at. We think you might be interested in it. Are you always hatching ideas, though? Are you somebody who has a sketchbook going at all times? And
I do, but, you know, they don't meet, you know, they're somewhat random, you know, and I don't, like, write, you know, if you looked at one of my things, you'd think some, you know, crazy person, you know. I do little sketches. Sometimes they become things. Sometimes they become a story. Sometimes they don't become anything. Sometimes they, you know. But, you know, I do. It's like my form of a journal, like a little bit of a drawing, a couple of words here or there. You know, that's my form of remembering things.
Mm-hmm. And do you find yourself going back over that material and sometimes fishing for things?
Well, yeah, because I think things that stay with you, they stay with you. You know, I mean, I always like, so when am I going to get rid of this demon? You know, when am I going to exercise this feeling? And the thing is, things that stay with you, they always stay with you. You know, no matter how try to get rid of them, you know. And it's like if I draw something, you know, it's like people say, well, the movies might be similar, this or that. I go like, well, you know, if I draw a dog or a person, unfortunately, it looks kind of the same each time I draw it. You know, it's like if you ask the guy who did whatever, you know, the guy who did, you know, Charlie Brown or something to draw it, you know, that's the style the guy does it. Yeah. So it's not like he's thinking about it. That's just what he does.
Yeah. Sure. Sort of like, oh, sure, of course.
You know, I'm kind of like, you know.
No, if he became overly self-conscious, that would be very hard.
Yeah, no, I don't. That's why I don't think, that's why I don't go on the internet. I don't look at things very much because, you know, I spend a long period of time, you know, being like a thing, like a creature. Mm-hmm. Then you try to become a human. And then you turned into a creature again. You know, it's just
is this like a daily experience, or is that?
Yeah, in fact. Yeah,
maybe not.
The full moon outside.
Speaking of that kind of
Wolfman.
Well, maybe a different kind of an evolution, though. I did want to ask you about becoming a parent. When you became a parent, did you find that it started affecting your thinking? I mean, it affects everything in your life, of course, everything about your life.
It's great, isn't it?
It sure is swell.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Now listen. My favorite thing is my daughter, our favorite movie, she was 3 years old, it was Easter, and her favorite movie is War of the Gargantuas. So I'm a successful parent. Thank you.
Well.
Thank you very
yes.
much.
Good well night, done. Well played, sir. Well played.
I love, because now that I'm older, I love asking my dad, what did you want to show me that I was just having none of?
Yeah.
What did you show me that I really liked? And you were like, yes, I win. Yeah. You know, it's those things.
No, I know. I'm very... Well, we'll see. They're about to become teenagers, so now I'm really... Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Trickier.
Than to just tell them you hate it. This is the worst movie. Don't watch this one.
No, I don't push anything on. No, except that. Yeah. No, I felt quite successful at that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she loves Sweeney Todd too.
Oh, well,
and she's six. I waited until she was five to show her that one.
That's good.
There are limits, after
Daddy,
all.
Daddy, why is he slitting his throat? No, for later. For later. That's. I hope she'd love blood if she's your kid. Now,
have they been to your sets? Do you have them visit
your
sets?
Yeah, but they get quite bored. You know, you've been on sets.
Sure.
It's like, when's something going to happen, you know? I mean, I don't invite around for the big explosion. It's usually, you know, what's going on?
Yeah.
Can we go home now?
I just mean in terms of getting used to the fact that there's artifice involved with blood and with some of the things.
They play a couple of dead children in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're very excited.
Yeah. Did you take them to Blackpool or Cornwall?
No, they were in the Gillette studio in London. A Gillette studio. It's an old factory that's asbestos filled. I only shoot in the best place.
Aww. And you took your kids to get asbestos. That's so nice. Little asbestos.
Life
never
is
hurt
tough,
anybody.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Gotta get used to everything.
The question is, how old will they have to be? Probably, maybe even a decade or two or three or four ahead of now to really appreciate Big Fish.
Well, no, they do. But, you know, the interesting thing is you see films and they're so fast-paced and cut. You know, they're used to, like, all the modern stuff.
Yeah.
I was very quite excited and touched when showed them a bit of old Ray Harryhausen stuff, which it looks so, you know, ancient, you know, to what everybody's used to today. Mm-hmm. And yet they still gravitated towards it, you know. And that's, you know, that to me is a good sign. It's like when you see things and, you know, like, you know, you wouldn't want to see Pingu, you know, those old stop-motion things, you know, done in any other medium. So I think kids, and so still is fast-paced and quick-cutting and everything that's going on today, they still, I think, some appreciate those sort of slower, artistic, more, you know, crude things that I grew up with anyway.
They get into Jason and the Argonauts?
Yeah, no, I mean, they appreciate Ray Harryhausen, which, again, I was impressed by.
You did it.
That's great.
That's a big star for you. Yeah.
Well, and a good story is a good story.
Yeah.
I mean, really, because even Harryhausen stuff, like the earliest experiments with computer animation, all right, now you can do that. That's fine. But it was John Lasseter and Bill Croyer and a few other people who found a way to use it, to make a funny film, to make an interesting film, to make a provocative film.
Yeah, that's what you say. It's all a tool. You know, technology is amazing. It's just use it to whatever you want to tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, have you shown them one of my dad's favorite movies, Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla?
Yeah, of course.
I love that movie.
I haven't shown them that anyway. They're not old enough for that one.
I think I'd agree. I would agree.
I didn't know that color existed for a long
time
in my life.
That I really don't want them to understand at the moment.
But you guys should all see Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. It's a real movie. It is a real movie.
Leonard Maltin presents.
At any time.
That one.
Anytime, any place. I'll be there.
No. I want to see his
I'll stand up to that. Right. Absolutely. There's nothing like Bella and Boris. Love them both. And you drew them a lot of times when you were a kid, because you grew up in the same generation I did, when all those movies were playing on TV. So that was my idea of what a horror movie was, which is why it's been a jolt of an adjustment to the modern era of torture porn and all different.
Please don't ever say that again.
No. Well, but I mean, that's
sounds
you know,
interesting.
We're here at Fantastic Fest, where every possible definition of the genre comes to life. But I grew up with the gothic horror, and that still gets me the most. And then ghost stories, eerie stories, creepy stories. I find those more appealing.
But also, what you're saying, there was weird stuff on television at the time. Because I remember, like, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, you know, black and white.
Yeah.
But the guy's wife's head gets a car accident, it's in a bowl and the thing. And it's on Saturday afternoon, you know, the guy's arm gets ripped off by a monster, and he's rubbing his bloody stump all the way down the steps. And it's like, this is on television on Saturday afternoon, for God's sakes.
But, you know, but
they don't do that anymore.
But that's another phenomenon, which doesn't get discussed much, is that the phenomenon of being 11 years old, and still feeling superior to the movies you're watching, because they're so ridiculously stupid or so obviously, you know, made. The effects are so bad, so cheesy. And to sit there and watch those or some of the old Saturday matinee serials and feel smug is a very heady feeling for an 11-year-old kid.
You were more advanced than me. I believe it all.
No, that's my problem. Now I believe, like, the stuff now. That's why I can't watch it.
No, I know. I get it. No, well, it's all true. It's all happening, probably.
My mom and I are covered in bruises. If you go to a scary movie with him, he's just like, why, God, why? It's not good.
Now, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski happen to be friends of mine, and they got a whoop. They'll be very, very pleased they got a whoop. Very nice.
I love their OJ thing. I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, yes, and they, of course.
I really, because that's a case of where television does something where their writing gets to be drawn. You get to experience the whole thing. That's why the new format of, like, longer format thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's opened a lot of doors for good storytelling. And they should take all the bows they deserve for that. Now, of course, they also wrote Ed Wood. And then just a couple of years ago, and you had been attached to it for a while as a producer, but they asked if you would be willing to direct their script, Big Eyes. And you said yes. And that turned out awfully well. But it was also the smallest scale movie you've ever made in terms of a feature film. And I wonder what that was like for you, to work on a modest scale.
Well, I mean, I've mainly done every movie as a studio movie. So yeah. I've been weird, you know, I've had a weird life that way, you mm-hmm. know. Never really done an independent film before, although I'm not sure working with Harvey Weinstein is an independent film. But there you go, you take whatever. But no, I mean, it was great. I mean, it's just fun. You know, it was a small movie, but I enjoyed. It was just getting right down to it with the actors and, you know, and Amy and Crystal. It was just fun. You know, I mean, it was a story that I related to because I grew up with that artwork and stuff, and I've mm-hmm. met Margaret before and had a weird, you know, had some commissions done mm-hmm. for even before I knew Scott and Larry were doing it. So it was a weird sort of karmic moment where I just wanted to do it. You know, it was a catharsis for me a bit.
Yeah. Well, it turned out awfully well.
We're getting the hook. But I want to ask you something that we try every week on the show is we like to ask people about hidden gems or just movies that they love that they don't think people have seen. Movies that you really, really, really want to recommend to people that maybe didn't get enough attention or maybe
a little
just
underappreciated.
Got a small release. Or it can be something huge. You're Tim Burton. Do what you want.
I always like blank out at these questions. It's like favorite. Okay. What's didn't get enough attention? Well, you know, I look at my favorite movies.
It can be anything you want.
You know, one of my favorites is The Omega Man, starring Charlton Heston. Mm-hmm. I saw that movie a zillion times, mm-hmm. and I will still see it. And I think Charlton Heston is very underrated.
He's very solid. I mean, some people find him stolid.
I think it's his most subtle performance. Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course. But I mean, you have to be able to pull that off.
It was the first blockbuster because it's like, it, when I saw it, it reminded me of, like, there's lines in it that it's like, this is like, you know, when Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'll be back and all that shit that goes on now. It's like when all the family is, the guys, and it, Charlton Heston goes like, how long have you people been working for the Internal Revenue Service? It's a longer line than I'll be back, or, you know, but it's the same kind of line. You know, it's like,
you start popping up on T-shirts.
Well, he could deliver that stuff. And I don't know who takes that place now. I don't know who can do that.
I don't know who can wear the jumpsuit like that with a little sailor cap and
I don't know. So many questions, so few answers. Tim, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Let's give him a big
round of applause. Thank you so much, Tim. Tim Burton. Live in Austin, Texas.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.